Right, as is customary at the start of all Tux Radar podcasts, we need to record some silence.
Did you just say Tux Radar?
Oh. at least that's out of the way now.
You see, it's all genuine. We don't just sit there and plan to say discoveries.
Okay, welcome to Series 2, Episode 18 of the Linux Voice podcast. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Ben Nuttall.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this fun packed. Say that again, Mike. I'm Mike Saunders. They seem to like it.
Has some sort of effect.
Yeah. Mike is the coolest.
No, it's all a lie.
We have super duper lightning news, super duper lightning finds, and then the other thing that we do.
Yeah, we should also say that Ben Nuttall's from the Raspberry Pi Foundation, so he's agreed to join us, which is great because he's awesome and they're awesome.
Thank you. You are too.
Thanks for joining us.
Right then.
Nice t-shirt.
I've swapped allegiance for the day.
So it's been almost exactly a year since we did the last Tux Radar podcast, and this seems like a nice way of doing it because it's almost where it started, the Linux Voice thing. And because we're doing this in this way, we can't really do it in the same way that we normally do, because we just talk for 45 minutes about news when we've only actually got half an hour, 25 minutes. So we're going to try and do a short news section. Then we've got some finds.
We do, yeah. And I don't know if they're necessarily Linux related,
no,
or whatever.
In fact, my notes are in there. And then if anybody wants to speak their brains... We can do that, but we were going to try and limit people to just a couple of minutes.
You mean vocalise your neurons?
Vocalise your neurons.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have the open ballot.
Voice of the masses.
Yeah. Which is actually related to our first news story, which is almost a link.
News?
Yes.
There's been one bit of news that's just overshadowed everything this fortnight, and that's Shellshock. I'm sure you're all aware of it, but it's a bash security flaw that can be remotely triggered to execute code and generally do bad things. It's one of those things. I saw the news and I thought, a bash security bug. And I thought, well, hang on, if you've got access to bash, you can do whatever you want anyway. So what does it matter? And then you sort of read through and it's like, actually, it can be remotely triggered through, a lot of it's through PHP spawning shells. And we'll get into more of what this actually means for open source in the voice of the masses later on.
Do you think it's a real threat? I mean, a real security threat? Are there going to be sites that are going to be compromised through...
Well, just looking at our log files on linuxvoice.com, there's so many attacks. I mean, they were all attacks targeting PHP pages that didn't exist. And we patched straight away anyway. But there's certainly a lot of people trying, and a lot of it looked like compromised servers being used to attack our sites.
A lot of Mormons.
Yes. We got attacked by a Mormon dating site. I'm not sure if that was relevant, but...
I'm not quite sure on the details, but if Apache is running, if the Apache is its own user and the user shell is bash, is that the vulnerability? If Ubuntu is running ZSH, is that a problem?
The PHP or whatever has to spawn a bash shell.
Right.
And you'll get the user of that shell will be the Apache user, usually www-data. See, they don't have like complete root access. Although I believe the DHCP bug or the DHCP issue could trigger a root shell. Although I haven't actually done that myself.
Because you've been running an exploitable server on your laptop. We did think the Wi-Fi would be a bit better, so we'd be able to get people to hack into it. But you were able to recreate an exploitable environment.
Yeah, it was actually harder than I was expecting to create an exploitable environment. You have to sort of switch a few defaults to get it. But, we were hoping to have the server running on the hotel Wi-Fi here that you could hack into, but the Wi-Fi kept kicking us off.
So we're secured by bad Wi-Fi.
Yes. we'll get on to Shellshock later on in Voice of the Masses. The second item of news, we've got two bits from Adobe. They're dropping reader support for Linux.
Hooray. Nah.
Yeah. Has anyone used that recently? In the last year, show of hands. One person.
I was tempted the other night, actually. I couldn't open a PDF that had a fillable form in it. and it says you need to download the latest version of Adobe, and I tried it on it was my mom's, actually. She called me up for help. She couldn't open it on Windows. I couldn't open it on Linux. I tried it on a Mac, and that version seemed to work. But so I thought the next step might be to try and download the official Linux version of the Adobe Reader, but I wasn't that fussed, so I didn't bother.
But this is PDF, the open standard PDF.
Yeah, yeah.
You're all familiar with the Free Software Foundation Europe campaign for the, what's it called, the free PDF reader campaign. So, you know, when people say, oh, you need to download this PDF from our website, fill out this form, instead of branding it with the Adobe logo, they should say you should link to list of free software PDF readers.
That's because people don't genuinely realize that PDF or A is an open format and is an open standard. You know, and yes, you're right. And part of that Adobe branding next to the download link helps people think it's just a locked-in proprietary.
Kind of similar to referring to probably in the early 2000s, you know, people who would have just associated Windows with being PC associated PCs with being a Windows computer, and you'd go, oh, you. It would be assumed, and that's the fault, really, the assumption.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Ocular is really good. I really like it. The problem that we've had, or people have mentioned, is that the form filling seems to only genuinely work. There's lots of governmental PDFs where you need to fill in a form. Mm-hmm. You type in fields, and there's some interactive part of Adobe's PDF reader that isn't replicated. Or I've noticed that with annotations in open source PDF readers, they all seem to add annotations differently. It's probably not part of the standard.
But in the UK, the David Cameron's thing about switching to PDFA, that doesn't include the form filling, does it?
Probably not. That's what I mean. I don't know if PDFA is part. I mean, if the interactive part is part of the standard, it should be, because it's.
Or should they not just use ODT files for that?
Yeah.
In conclusion, yes.
Yes.
And more news in a similar vein. Photoshop is coming to Linux through Chrome OS.
Excellent. Everybody's got really excited about it, and I don't get it. Isn't it just running? It's like a VNC session with Photoshop running somewhere in the cloud.
That's what I thought. In Photoshop,
so it's not actually native, not a native like Linux installable on the Chrome OS.
Well, as far as I'm aware, it will appear that way from the point of view of the user. But obviously, Chrome OS, you're all in the cloud and whatnot anyway. It's not.
That's quite disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, Photoshop is one of the sort of things that a lot of people really depend on. And it is, you know, there are free software alternatives, but for hardcore photographers and that lot, they need it.
Well, at least. I mean, it may not be coming to proper desktop Linux anytime soon, but if you can get it on a Chromebook, then that means more people using Photoshop. It means more competition for GIMP. So indirectly, it will probably push GIMP to get better, because GIMP is so far out there ahead of all the other, well, not Critter, but as a photo image editing tool, GIMP is by far and away the number one, but it still lacks, you know, CMYK, lots of stuff that, like I say, people need.
And a sensible name as well.
Well, yeah. So this is a kick up the arse, if nothing else.
The other thing, I mean, we were just having this conversation, actually, with somebody who came up to us and said, I noticed that you were using a Mac. And the reason why we do put the magazine together in InDesign, and InDesign is Adobe, and it's something we never wanted to do. It was done really because it was the easiest thing to do for us, and we work with a designer, and she only knows how to work with the Mac. Now, in fact, for the issue that we're just going to start, we're going to start working with Stacey to try and create some articles with Inkscape and InDesign. But it's going to be a learning curve.
Scribus, you mean?
Scribus. So if there's some helpful transition in Adobe being able to let us run Linux, and even if we happen to be using their virtualized cloud instance, it's going to help. And also, I think it comes as part of the Creative Cloud subscription. So people will be able to just migrate away from OS X or Windows without really their IT person could put Linux on it and they don't even know anything's changed. And that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing.
And that's the news for the fortnight.
Wow.
That was fast.
Thanks, Ben. We should have Brad Sucks music playing here. Yeah.
I don't know whether anyone's got any finds of the fortnight, but I thought if we did our own finds, because we never have any, and if you guys want to think about something that you may have discovered, we could maybe ask a couple of you if you've heard of anything cool over the last couple of weeks. My finds over there in my laptop pack, so I've got to go and get them.
Oh, okay.
So if somebody else wants to have a go, have you got any finds?
I have a find. My find was a pub find yesterday. 20% of the analysts at GCHQ have some form of... Now that you're here, I'm going to get it wrong. some form of... it's either dyslexia or they're either on the autistic spectrum. And in the general population, that's just 1.1%. So hugely overrepresented. And also, only 15% of people who are on the autistic spectrum are in full-time employment. So there's a massive concentration of people with autism and what was called Asperger's, but is now just on the autistic spectrum, who are actively sought by GCHQ when they're recruiting. They look for the lateral thinking, the analytical skills that go along with that condition. It's not necessarily Linux related, but it's
never stopped us.
It's never stopped you before.
It's hackery.
Yeah, no,
it's kind of hackery.
Yeah,
kind of.
Yeah. Well, my find is last year, I might have mentioned it in the old podcast, that I filed a bug report for Kate, and because there's a really powerful plugin which is a bit of a discovery. It's snippets in Kate, which is KDE's text editor. Snippets are like a macro replacement module where you use JavaScript to do things like, if you want to, you can add XML or HTML tags or do lots of stuff. But one of the very basic replace commands didn't work, and I filed a bug report and didn't really hear anything back apart from this week. It was bug 32218. It's just been fixed, just like that, out of the blue. So that was thanks to Sven, whoever he is, who fixed the Kate Snippets bug. And that was my discovery. That, in fact, even though it had gone silent, I think it's been fixed because they moved to Qt 5. It's all part of the KDE 5 transition. And Kate and Snippets are really powerful if you need to convert documents from a proprietary format like InDesign and put them onto the internet, which we've got to do. Because it's been almost 9 months now since the very first issue, we're going to have to put up. It's not a chore. This is what we wanted to do, but this is the problem that we've got to solve. The first issue is going to become Creative Commons in the next couple of weeks, so we've got to try and make it more than just PDF.
Weren't we thinking about chucking everything on GitHub, for instance?
People
can pull all the content and modify it.
And in fact, there's something that I don't know how much we should do. You know, if. Because people can do what they want with the content. I suppose we just got to unlock it. We have got a lot better. Ben's been creating the EPUB versions of the magazine, and that's to do with marking up the stuff in InDesign, which is actually pretty good at exporting XML, but I know we've got a long way to go with EPUB. Anyone else want to find?
No, there's nothing about synthesizers there, Graham. It's so disappointing.
I haven't mentioned them for ages. I'm just scared and slightly humiliated about it now.
It's because it's live. We can't put the boredom sound effect on.
Yeah. The big echoey room.
Ticking. What's that?
Any discoveries or finds over here?
I have a couple of finds. The first one, I feel really bad. Someone emailed this to me and I've forgotten to... I wrote down all about the find and I forgot to write down who emailed it to me. So I apologise to you if you might even be in the room. Shout out if you are. If not, we'll put it in the podcast note. But it's a thing called WebSDR.
I love the way you say that and it automatically happens.
It's brilliant. We'll get the secretary to put it in the notes. It's WebSDR from WebSDR.org, and SDR is Software Defined Radio. I know there was a talk about it earlier today. And what they do on this website is they stream. You can put an antenna, plug it into your computer, you can pull down the radio signal, and they stream the entire radio signal over the web. And you can have a Java applet that you can tune in. So it's not like internet radio where they stream a channel. They stream the actual radio spectrum, and you can then tune in to any point on that channel. So you can have a dozen people on the same stream all tuned into different channels. And I just thought that was really interesting. And it runs on the Raspberry Pi. The streaming runs from a Raspberry Pi. And there's loads of them on the web. And it was, it's quite websdr.org. Go and have a look. And another thing, I got really frustrated with
Have you got internet yet?
No, I haven't got internet yet.
Still.
Actually, you found out you haven't got a phone line, haven't you? Just when the BT engineer turned up.
Well, no active phone line, yeah. And anyway, at some point I'll get internet.
In the mass murderer's house, she didn't have a phone line.
No.
4G is your friend.
Well, it's a really old house. And it's stone walls, big, thick stone walls. So I get fantastic reception in the garden. But inside the house...
You'll have internet connection 3 months a year.
Yeah. I got in a right strop with our BitTorrent client that we were running on our server. And I was just like, all right, it just wasn't working. We couldn't work out why. And anyway, we got it fixed. But I was like, I'm not going through this again. So renting a seed box now to upload our ISOs for our cover disks so you can download them. And I thought, well, you know, we've got 100 gig of space. We might as well chuck some distros on there just sort of to help download them. And yeah, I just picked a few at random, and they've all been sat there seeding, and sort of looking. Some of them, loads of people have downloaded from, and some of them, the ratio's barely changed. And I don't know if this is to do with the ratios that we're streaming lots of, is because other people who download that distro just cut off as soon as they've downloaded, whereas on other distros, people actually seed for a while.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You should open that data. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
At the moment, it's only a weekend's worth of data. It's not that scientific.
Who's winning on the show?
Write a paper on it.
I've got them in order from the least shared from us to the ones we've streamed the most of. CentOS, they've got loads of seeders, barely touched us. Triskwell, so much Slackware's been used a little bit more. Debian... then Magea, then the two that have really we've streamed loads of are Kali and Nopix.
Nopix,
yeah,
still kicking Kali. Around.
Yeah. Kali, the security pen testing distro.
Does that mean that they're more popular than other distros? Just that other people who've downloaded them are uncharitable human beings?
Well, I think there's a few things. So the Nopix was a brand that was pretty much the day it was released, so that's probably skewed that. The Kali, I'm not so sure why. It might be that people weren't seeding as much. It might just be one of those things. I don't know.
Changing the subject, did you say that you'd had a complaint for your Tor exit node?
Yes, I've been running a Tor exit node for 5 months, and I finally got a complaint. Some honeypot. Someone runs a deliberately vulnerable server to try and lure in hackers to catch them, and someone's been going through my Tor exit node to this honeypot in the Czech Republic, and they've sent me an email saying, "Oh, someone from your servers." Up to no good. And I sent them an email back saying it's a Tor exit node. What do you expect?
Is there any kind of threatening language?
No, they were. It was a reasonably helpful email. We think, we think your system's been compromised. Oh, here's what's from our
by analog. Tor.
Yeah, and they haven't replied to me, so I assume they're quite happy. It hasn't upset the hosting provider, so.
So I've got a couple of Python 3 related finds, if you'd like. I was at PyCon UK in Coventry a couple of weeks ago.
That sounded brilliant. It sounded
yeah,
fantastic.
Really good conference.
I really
I've,
wish we'd gone, actually.
I've never made it to PyCon UK before because I could never get away from like just normal, you know, my normal sort of developer jobs. Never sort of really had a scope to go to conferences and things. So unless they were the weekends and local, I didn't really go. But been to about 5 or 6 in the last few weeks, which is great. We were at PyCon UK, and Carrie-Anne gave a fantastic keynote and sort of said about, you know, her journey through the last couple of years at PyCon and how they've helped the community in Python has helped her in education and helped her kind of help other people and help train other people. So one of the other things she said was that there are a number of libraries that we use in Raspberry Pi resources and our education stuff that haven't been ported to Python 3 yet. And she's saying, we're trying to do your job and support, you know, tell people to use Python 3 and help them onto that, but there are developers that are holding us back by not porting these libraries. So one of the ones is that As you may know, we have Minecraft Pi, so the Minecraft Pocket Edition ported to the Raspberry Pi. Comes with a Python interface, so you can program the Minecraft world in one window and see
the interface,
see the changes on the other,
and not the game.
Yeah. So we said that, you know, that Mojang provided us with that, and it's great that they did that. And but they wrote it in Python 2. So we said we'd really like a Python 3 port. And so my find is the people who came up and said, yeah, we've just been having go, and we think we've done it. So they provided that. It's on GitHub now, and you can test it. And they've actually gone. There's a group of us, and I'm joined in on all the conversations. We're sort of having. We've got IRC, and we use the GitHub issues to communicate and talk about what's going on. We're sort of project managing that, and it's going really well. They're actually adding more features and making it more intuitive and more Pythonic, because it's very Java style methods and things like that at the moment. So. Yeah, that was really cool, the find of those developers who were keen to jump on board and do the project.
So these are Microsoft developers?
No. This is the Python community just being cool. And the other one is I needed a Python library for talking to Twitter, so sending tweets from Python. And I've seen one used in a bunch of projects people have done before using Tweepy. And I've noticed that's only in Python 2. I was looking at trying to port it or something like that, and I had a quick look. Then I discovered Alex Bradbury actually mentioned another one he'd found called Twython. Works out of the box, works really well, really good documentation, so much better than Tweepy. And yeah, so I used that. I built a project with it the other night when I couldn't sleep. So
actually, they're really good Linux-related finds.
Yeah. Well done, Ben.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
Which means I can follow up with a non-Linux-related find. I found just a couple of hours ago, and some people might know about this. It's about how a bug can have unintended consequences. Quite a few years ago, a company called DMA Design was making a game called Race and Chase. It was a top-down sort of adventure game. You run around, do some missions, stuff like that. And during the development, somebody put in a bug that made the police go completely and utterly insane, like super aggressive, attacking you all the time, running over pedestrians and stuff. And they thought, oh, this is a bug, this is a problem. But this beta version of this game was given out to some reviewers, and they said, this is fantastic, you should make the game based around these cops going insane and trying to kill everybody. And so Grand Theft Auto was born.
Oh, really?
Yep. There you go.
Oh. Well, we've actually only got 9 minutes left. So
that sounds like a good time for the halfway reminder. Yeah. If you like this podcast and would prefer to see it in written form, there's a magazine.
Slightly more professionally done.
Slightly yeah. more. But there's Linux Voice, which you can buy from all good news agents and some adequate ones. And also from shop.linuxvoice.com. Mm. Oh, it's time for the other thing.
Open ballot.
Yes. What was the ballot this time? I normally do this section, but I was out having a packet of crisps. I missed the preparation.
There has been no preparation.
It's shell shock, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and how has it changed your view of open source security after Heartbleed and shell shock?
Do you think, should we ask the audience? I think this is a good point if we're going to have any. I think it's a good opportunity. So I think the question was, has the recent vulnerabilities in open source software and in perhaps Linux changed people's perception of how secure Linux is as an operating system.
And open source in general.
And open source in general, which has often for a long time been quoted as being, you know, unbreakable.
Well, given enough eyeballs or bugs are shallow, Linus's law, and somebody has something to say then.
No, it hasn't changed my perception or my feeling about how secure my software is, because I don't think that having an open code base can inherently make your software more secure than closed software. What it means is when big scary stuff like this happens, we all know about it. We don't just, you know, you don't get a patch that comes along next Tuesday and fixes some stuff which you may or may not have heard about, because you may or may not know a guy who knows a guy's stuff, which is public knowledge. So in fact, I quite welcome the fact that we know about all of this stuff.
But has it changed the perception? I mean, maybe outside of the Linux and open source world, where people have just thought of it as being secure?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when part of my job is talking to people about open source and whether, you know, like what the actual differences are, and we never say it's more secure. We never use that as a reason, because I don't think it is.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing about the licensing model or the development model of open source software which means it's going to be more secure. It's all about what the code does.
Yeah. No, thanks. I agree.
Is anyone else?
Yeah.
We don't like not being on the stage. It hasn't changed my view, but I was listening to a technology podcast that some friends from work were doing, and one of the guys on it, completely straight, just said, yeah, I'm really worried about using open source software now because of all these recent things. And I was sort of screaming kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I haven't had a chance to talk to them yet because I'm quite interested to know exactly why they think
that. And I think that's maybe what we were thinking when we thought didn't think that much about the question, but it's the kind of, I always used to use the example of my mum, but I got in trouble for saying that. So it's the kind of thing my non-Linux using uncle would say, oh, I've been hearing some terrible things about Linux. You know, I've heard, you know, it's insecure now and that hackers are taking over it. And I think that, I don't actually think it's a bad thing that might happen, because it kind of, you know, it doesn't, people's expectation is more realistic, and of course open source is vulnerable.
I mean, when something has sat in the code base for 20 years,
and I think I mean we should let other people speak, but I think that's a wider problem. It's the same with Heartbleed, the fact that there were just three people maintaining such an important piece of code.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that about the length of time it's been there. It's actually the if you call it a bug, the bug predates the possibility for the vulnerability. So it's a bug that arised when a new feature of like the web came around. So that it used to be that it was a feature that you could send, you know, variables between environments, you know, between processes, child and parent processes, and that was needed for a lot of functionality in code before. Then the web was born and it became
added an extra dimension that wasn't ever part of it. Yeah.
I'm not sure how normal people view open source, but I think it's just a consequence of this post-Snowden, post-Heartbleed world, and we've got so many eyes on open source now, and it's a good thing that bugs are being found, and if you can do anything to change the view of open source, it's a point now.
Yeah, and how it's dealt with, how quickly it's dealt with, yeah.
Certainly, the number of developers for OpenSSL was just bizarre. You think it works because of, you know, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow, but clearly there were only four eyeballs.
That's blaming it or not. So the shock for me was that when I read about this
bug
on BBC
News. How was it reported?
Well, at first I was kind of thinking, well, how on earth could there be a bug in the batch that would be possibly as good?
Well, maybe how the vast majority of us know. You know, there's only a few individuals who know.
The other thing that's kind of very, very small, the other set of it's great easy to discover because it was also it's kind of damaged by almost my I feel quite proud of being able to use it.
Yeah.
It's kind of damaged that kind of smugness.
But at the same time, since we started running our own mail server and we get like 200 spam email messages with, you know, virus-ridden screensavers every day, you just, you know, I'm still thanking God that I'm using Linux.
Yeah. I think what's happened with Heartbleed is actually a complete vindication of the open source methodology, because there's certain things we know are insecure, like Flash always has bugs, Java always has bugs, but we don't have any option but to continue using them from Adobe and from Oracle. Whereas what happened with Heartbleed is actually some people forked the project and really focused on the security, and we've now got that option that people have stripped back features that were introducing bugs, and they've taken it back to a more secure, smaller base, and that's only been possible because it's open source. If it was a bug in a commercial software, we'd have just still be using software with more bugs in it. Yeah, people couldn't have got, you know, more eyeballs on the code because it would have been locked behind some locked doors.
Okay, we've got another question.
I said a similar thing yesterday. That it shows the power of open source that when it's discovered, anyone in the world can have a look at the code and patch the code and say it gets fixed really quickly. So that just shows the power of it.
I can't see how it would work any other way, you know, trusting in somebody else to do it, or just trusting in running their binary software. It's difficult.
If anything, I think the perception that should be changed and is changing is that getting rid of sacred cows, because something that sort of does. For a very long time, especially with OpenSSL, people always used to say, oh, don't write your own encryption routines, use the ones in SSL, because they're the guys that really know what they're doing. And it's all been audited and many eyes and so on. And so there weren't very many competing OpenSSL libraries. And similarly with Bash, it's like, why would you use a different shell from Bash? Bash is the standard. Well, this is why. So
I think there's a point there, is about monocultures as well. You know, we always say how bad things were with the Microsoft monoculture. When everybody's using Bash and is vulnerable to this, apart from Debian and Ubuntu with Dash.
We've got a couple more minutes, so maybe...
It hasn't really damaged my opinion of open source, because in the case of Heartbleed and Shellshock, they were both patched quite quickly after the... In the case of the Shell Shock one, I haven't been following that closely because I switched to Z Shell or something. commercial companies are notorious for just having things reported to them and not fixing them, just sitting on them.
And we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And open source is fixed.
So the last word goes to Stuart.
Do you not think it's illustrative of... First of all, the power of branding, and certainly that we're now a big deal. I mean, Apple bring out a new Play-Doh phone, which bends everybody in your pocket, and everyone christens it Bendgate, right? Presumably we had really serious security bugs beforehand, but they were all called CVE-10135. And then people christened Heartbleed and Shellshock, so we can talk about it that easily. But people are bothering to do that christening because we're a big enough deal that it's worth it.
That's a really good point. And in fact, the power of that Heartbleed logo is what made it viral, isn't it? I mean...
to the guy who said he feels that his smug mode has been damaged, I don't think it's damaged, it's just moved, because I get loads of emails from Windows Lover friends who said, look at this, and send me the link to the BBC article. So, the smug just moved. That's it.
I think that's about all the time that we've got. We didn't know if we'd be able to make it last half an hour, but we could easily have made it last longer. So thank you all very much. Thanks for all the support over the last year as well. And it's been great being here. And see you in 2 weeks.